The world is like a ride at an amusement park, and when you choose to go on it, you think it's real, because that's how powerful our minds are. And the ride goes up and down and round. It has thrills and chills, and it's very brightly colored, and it's very loud, and it's fun for a while. Some people have been on the ride for a long time, and they begin to question, is this real, or is this just a ride? And other people have remembered, and they come back to us, and they say, hey, don't worry, don't be afraid, ever, because this is just a ride. And we kill those people. Shut him up. We have a lot invested in this ride. Shut him up. Look at my furrows of worry. Look at my big bank account and my family. This has to be real. It's just a ride. But we always kill those good guys who try and tell us that. You ever notice that? And let the demons run amok. But it doesn't matter, because it's just a ride. And we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now. To a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace.
Welcome, brothers and sisters. I'm Michael. And that was Bill, the late great Bill Hicks, that is, as quoted in the track Just a Ride by Vigilant Guardian. Bill Hicks' timeless message is also a timely reminder in these crazy days of stock market plunges, bank buyouts, plummeting values. Because chances are, whenever or wherever you're listening to this, the news is telling you pretty much one thing. Be afraid. They're like DJs with many records but just one song. Fear. The Fear remix. Fear, the album version. Radio-friendly Fear. So we interrupt that broadcast to remind you that it's just a ride. And that we have the power to change it if we want to. We simply need to be the change we wish to see. And to unite with those with whom we share common cause. Coming up on this podcast, we have Stefan talking to legendary Middle East correspondent Robert Fisk. Danish professor of chemistry Niels Harrit talks Building 7 with Kat. And then we all get our walking shoes to join the peace march hand in hand with peace activist Brian Hall. But first, Rob from We Are Change talks activism with animal rights campaigner Keith Mann.
Classified as an animal rights extremist, something I'm very proud of, a political activist, and often in a lot of trouble.
How did you get into it?
Well, I was woke up first, I think, in about 1982, very early in the 80s, when I left school, when I discovered a slaughterhouse. And then this whole lie that we're living became real to me. I kind of realised that I wasn't being told the truth about a lot of things, but it started with that, with the whole animal industry, because I had no idea that slaughterhouses existed. Meat came in a supermarket in a cellophane wrap packet, and you know they lived in a farm, and there was nothing in the middle. So I was devastated. I was physically devastated when I discovered this place, and from then on, it's just been a rude awakening for me. I think I do see society waking up slowly to all this now, and it's something that the animal rights movement and various other people have been banging on about for a long time. It isn't just about the violence we're inflicting on animals; it's about what we're doing to ourselves. You know. People, it is about people as well, because people are dying. We're growing crops to feed to farm animals, to produce a luxury product that people crave because that's how they've been brought up. But people are dying, you know, there is enough food on this planet, but we're giving it to animals. It's insane. And all the methane these farm animals are now emitting, which is boiling up our planet, which affects all of us. The water that farm animals consume is obscene, the amount of water that the cows need. It's incredible, you know. And this is all part of the same picture, the same problem, and we need to address it at root level, you know, and there's a lot of good people at root level that could be making a big difference by taking animal products out of their diet.
And of course this spreads into the whole food industry with food additives and the processes in producing food. You know, I don't know if you know anything about aspartame or MSG.
Absolutely, yeah. It's all got to be taken out of our diet, absolutely. There are a lot of big problems and that relate to animal farming in this industry, and stop supporting these people who are lying to us at every level about what we're eating.
So, what do you think about our taxes being used to subsidise that industry as well? Is it not?
Well, I like what our taxes are used for. Period. Yeah. You know, wars for the most part. A lot of our money's going to fight wars. I certainly never asked for that. I wasn't asked if that was where it should be used. And to subsidise this industry, it's insane. And it has to stop, and it has to stop now.
So, what about vivisection? What do you think the real purpose of that is?
Well, it's a money-making business, again, and it isn't just about animals. You know, a lot of people say, well, you know, people who aren't aware will argue that human beings are more important. But the reality is that in this country alone, every year, tens of thousands of people die because they're being given products that have been tested on animals and passed as safe. These are human beings, vulnerable human beings, who are already ill, who are already suffering, are being told that this thing's been tested on an obese mouse in a laboratory. It didn't do it any harm. Have a go. And it's killing people, and it's obscene. And it's one of the biggest causes of hospitalisation in this country and death, animal-tested products. It's about making money. It's not about finding cures for diseases.
So you seem to be suggesting that they're using this to say that it's safe, using the test to suggest that these things are safe so they can flog them to us.
Well, aspartame was tested on animals. Presumably it was passed as safe. If it wasn't, why has it been put on the market? All the pesticides we have to wash off our food have been passed as safe in laboratory tests on animals. But they kill people. They're cancerous and we know it. So, yeah, their animals are an alibi. They're not a means to finding cures for all human ills, because clearly it's not working. There are more people dying of more diseases, illnesses and viruses now than there ever have been, so something isn't working.
And how do you think they're getting away with this? Do you think the media are complicit?
Well, the media are the biggest part of the problem. We're not getting the information about how dangerous these products are, the secrecy. For example, the Freedom of Information Act, which, you know, sounds wonderful, but if you're a vivisector, if you're into testing products on animals, you don't have to reveal the information about those tests to anybody. They're exempt from the Freedom of Information Act. But hang on a minute, this is our money that you're using to test things on animals for our benefit. We can't see the results. Now, that's at best very, very suspicious, and it needs addressing.
Yeah, so, and obviously the government aren't putting down rules to make the media investigate these things, because they're in on it as well, aren't they?
Well, from where I'm sat, I am kind of on the front line of this campaign against vivisection to get at least an inquiry. I want it banned. It doesn't work. I know it doesn't work. I've seen the evidence. But the media are very, very complicit in this whole secrecy thing. And I see that the pressure that's being put on the animal rights movement now by the pharmaceutical industry to stop us doing what we're doing, to expose what they're doing.
Yeah. Okay. So, what other are you involved in any other campaigns, or is it just that?
I don't really like the label thing, but I can classify myself as an environmental activist. I'm very much an animal rights activist. That's what I do. And if I had more time, we had 24 hours of being awake, I would do a lot more things, but I do what I can in that arena. I recycle all my products, I turn all the lights off, I get stressed with all my friends who don't connect with these little things that are important. And the whole lie that we've been told by people that control us, the 9/11 thing, for example, that conspiracy drives me, and all the other things that these people are doing to destroy our planet and our way of life. But I am ultimately, I am an animal rights activist. That's kind of what I do every day, really.
Sure. Do you think there's any way that we can bring these different activist groups together? Because I'm sure they agree on an awful lot, you know, about protests, freedom to protest, etc.
Well, it is key to what we're doing and to our survival. I think that all the forward-thinking people in our society do come together. And as you say, we don't all agree on every little detail, but what these people are doing to us, to the animal rights movement, primarily, is going to affect every other protest movement. And we do need to come together. And I don't know quite what it is, why, you know, the whole violence that we inflict on animals is key to it. It is the root of the problem. If we can get rid of that, it will bring a lot of other things on board. And I do fail to understand sometimes why people who are very aware of the environmental destruction that's going on and the whole 9/11 thing, the 7/7 thing and all these other big issues, why they're still prepared to inflict violence on animals and not, you know, encompass this, the animal kingdom in our generosity, if you like. I don't know what it is, I don't know why we can't come together, but we so need to come together, otherwise we're all going to fall, you know, united we stand.
Yeah, indeed. Where do you think we go from here? What do you think?
Well, we don't hide away.
If
I had all the answers then.
what do you think, a few solutions might be? What do you think we could do differently?
Well, we could come together, we could unite more. This is very important. Every movement, the environmental movement, the peace movement, all these radical movements that the government will send their police out to contain, control and destroy, need to come together as one unit and work together. Because we do have the power. There are a lot of decent people, a lot of good activists, a lot of thinking people who want to make this world a better place. But we're all a little bit isolated in our own little environments, and it needs to be one cohesive movement. That's a priority, I think. And obviously we need control of the media, but that comes a little bit later. But we need to come together and work together. I mean, I don't know what quite the answer is. I don't want to suggest we have more meetings, but people do need to work together and understand that, you know, there is a big, broad movement of people who want change, want to bring down this system that's destroying our planet. And quite how we go about that, I'm not sure, but we do need to start thinking outside the box a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I understand there's a regular gathering on the 11th of every month, and that was primarily to signify September the 11th, but it seems to be a day when people can go down there and know that there's going to be other people down there that want the freedom that demand the freedom to protest. So do you think that could help?
Absolutely, it's a good starting point, I think, definitely, yeah. And I understand numbers are picking up there, so it would be a good focal point, I think, for different movements to get together.
A little less than a year ago, when we had our radio show, a show which was effectively hustled off the air because of our dogged determination to explore 9/11 truth, Simon from We Are Change UK interviewed Rodney Shakespeare about the money system. Now, we're very fond of talking about the money system in We Are Change UK, not just because we never have any. That's pretty normal, unless a kind owner like you visits our website, which is wearechange.org.uk, and donates some to us. Every penny goes into material for spreading truth now. Anyway, I digress. What I was going to say was, we're always talking about money, because understanding the money system is crucial to understanding how the world really works. If you listen to Simon's interview, remember this is a little less than a year ago. Rodney Shakespeare makes predictions which are pretty eerily accurate. If he knew all this, and therefore we knew all this, or found out all this, what about the people that run the world? Were they really, really caught by surprise?
This is Simon Moore from We Are Change, and I'm here with Rodney Shakespeare at the weekly money reform table in Euston. So, what's the London Global Table all about?
Well, it focuses on the key issue to get a new economics and a new politics. At the centre of it is the understanding that money is created by the banking system out of nothing. Interest is added, as distinct from administration cost, and that it does not direct the money to the purposes of the spreading and development of productive capacity. And in short, that mechanism at the moment is responsible for the coming global collapse. In ways which I can't go into detail now, it is responsible for the environmental collapse. It is responsible for the failure to address issues of poverty. And ultimately, it is responsible for the large-scale concentrations of power which enable autocratic and torturing regimes to prevail.
Okay, now you're quite an expert in things to do with money. You've written several books, I understand, on the subject.
Four or five, yes.
You talk about the interest. Now, I think some people will be familiar with interest from their credit cards. What is interest, if you could explain it briefly?
Yes. There are two things to distinguish. There is administration charge, which is always something which ought to be paid. If you do work for me, then you should be paid for that work. But interest is something totally different. It's best to think of it as a peculiar sort of tax, which is put on, and it operates totally independently of whether or not anybody has done any work. And then generally, it not only operates as a tax, periodically being incurred and being incurred again, but in fact it compounds. That is to say, if the debt has not been repaid, then you start to pay interest on interest. And in no time at all, a sum of money, say for example, borrowed £100 borrowed at 15%, would, if not paid at all, would double in 4.5 years. That's the rule of 72.
Right.
And that's the effect of interest. And virtually all people today, 18, 19 or 20, are going to be caught by compound interest because the grip of this mechanism is getting stronger and stronger, and it's producing disaster in the world. They're telling you you're paying off some interest, but effectively other charges may not be paid off and may be increasing. I'd be very, very cautious about such agreements.
So it's actually quite a misnomer, because credit sounds like something free, something you get. Debt sounds like something that you...
A misnomer, Simon, is the least of it. I'm afraid the society is governed by its vocabulary and its concepts. For example, although Peter Chell and I got an admission from the governor of the Bank of England that the banking system creates money out of nothing, most people would never know that and would never come across it in the whole of their lives.
Yeah.
And it's a question of vocabulary.
Can you say that again? The banking system creates money out of...
The banking system, 97% of the new money supply in this country is created out of nothing by the banks simply pressing buttons on the computers and then adding interest. Interest which consists of interest and administration cost. And, but people don't understand it. This is one of the great truths which is kept from the public by a combination of a failure in education. All the economics departments in this country and in the United States are all stitched up, so this issue of money supply is barely discussed. The other thing which is not discussed is economic history, so they don't know about the 1930s slump. That's another matter. But it's this combination of a clouding and of obfuscating of the fundamental issues which decide society and decide the economy the way it works today, combined with a lack of education, so that the public do not understand things like money comes. It is not gold. It is a legal right which is created by the pressing of a computer. This is not an attack on the banks, because all the people who work in banks, they don't understand that how the money is in fact created, and then it's deposited into another branch of the bank, which comes back as real money, as it were. But it's been created here and deposited there.
Yeah.
And this is why you have two results. One is you have an eternal inflation of some sort going on right the way throughout the world all the time. And secondly, because it's interest-bearing money and only the principal is created and not sufficient for the interest, the whole system requires that the total amount of debt should increase.
Constantly.
It constantly has to increase. It is not a question of only of national debt increasing,
yeah,
but it's national debt, personal debt, corporation debt. And this goes on till you get a situation like we're probably experiencing at this moment. For one reason or another, you get a crack in confidence.
An implosion.
I think you're looking on an implosion. It is going to develop perhaps over the next 18 months.
Right.
It won't be exactly between here and next weekend. But all the time you're seeing it's manifesting itself in many different ways, in many different aspects, right the way around the world. And you're going to get a colossal cracking of confidence, a withdrawal of credit. And I'm afraid you're going to look at disaster for a lot of people.
Okay, Rodney, thanks very much.
It's a pleasure,
That's
Simon.
Brilliant, thank okay. you.
I met him in Sudan, first of all, and then I met him twice in Afghanistan. And he wanted to see me after 9/11, but I couldn't reach him. I actually was heading for the location where he was in Afghanistan. The Taliban were taking me. And it was a huge American air raid on the village in front. And I said I wanted to have a try at getting through, and the Taliban said, no, they'd die. The last time I saw him, you know, he changed a bit, like we all do over the years. You know, from when I first saw him to when I last saw him, it certainly changed. But his vanity had grown a bit. He was always very self-righteous, and dangerously self-confident. And the last words he said to me, which I wrote into my notebook, as we were on the mountaintop, so cold that when I woke up, I spent the night there, I woke up in the morning, I had ice in my hair. And it was this huge concrete camp with underground bunkers built by the CIA, of course. No wonder they know where to shoot at. And he said, from this mountain upon which you're sitting, we destroyed the Soviet army and destroyed the Soviet Union. And then he said, and I pray that God permits us to turn America into a shadow of itself. There's the actual words. When I was going through my research on this book, I found in my notebooks, I keep every bit of paper, hundreds of thousands of things in my archive. And I'd written two lines hurriedly in the margin with the word rhetoric, ? Couldn't be more wrong, could I? And I do remember I was crossing the Atlantic on a 9/11 plane tour around the farm, of course. And when I got back to Europe and I saw the television pictures of this great fog, dust, and smoke drifting throughout Manhattan, I remember thinking, well, you know, New York is now a shadow of itself. There wasn't much doubt we were involved in that. And it was not the CIA.
That was award-winning journalist Robert Fisk, Middle East correspondent for the Independent newspaper, and author of The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East. He was talking about his dealings with Osama bin Laden. Fisk wrote an article questioning some of the aspects of 9/11, but then seemed, like many before him, to back down for whatever reason. Stefan from We Are Change caught up with him at a recent event.
Yeah, I mean, basically, it was about the 9/11 article you wrote.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you know the problem I described as I have raver problems. There's always, not tonight, sure. Actually, but there's always someone who's, yeah. Who's going to come out and say, you know, don't you realise that George Bush and CIA were all behind 9/11, which is ridiculous. I thought it was important to write that piece because I don't believe in conspiracy theories, but there are clearly things we don't know, which we should know. What's happened over 9/11 is you've got this whole bunch of crazes making all kinds of claims, you know, it could be Martians or something, and you know, there was no one in the airplane, so what happened to the passengers? And then you get the other lot who stick totally to the US narrative, which has lots of holes in it and answer questions. And what I was trying to do with the piece was to say, hold on, mainstream reporting can also include these doubts that they still haven't been answered properly, not to my satisfaction. And you see, in the American press now, there simply is no desire to do that. You don't get brownie points by questioning authority in New York Times or Washington Post or the LA Times or whatever, Chicago Tribune. Sure. And so I was trying to make doubt about 9/11 mainstream, not conspiracy theories, but sure. Doubt.
What sort of response, was there any backlash to it? Because it's very uncommon for journalists to bring up those questions in the mainstream media. What sort of response did you get?
Nothing, pretty much. I got a few letters from people full of conspiracy theories, of course. I think there was one critical comment in some newspaper about me, you know, Fisk has joined the ranks of the ravers or something. But I don't, I'm trying to remember, actually. I think it's in the book, the new book, this article you're talking about, along with the Lockerbie one. It didn't create, I wasn't intending it to create a great stir, I just wanted to try and move it into a bit more into the light. Because, you know, I'm a reporter on a major newspaper, I'm not writing for... You know, a monthly in a left-wing community in South Dakota.
Sure. Did you follow on that research? It felt like from the article that you'd done a little bit of research.
Well, the Lockerbie.
I'm going to stick with 9/11 because of time.
No, short. Look, you have to understand something. I'm in Beirut, not in New York.
Sure.
I have real conspiracy theories, which are genuine, out in the Middle East. I've got enough to cope with. I've got enough countries, enough wars, enough massacres, enough mendacity, without worrying about 9/11. I mean, I've been to New York. I was on my way there when the hijackings and deaths and everything occurred, and I've seen Ground Zero because I've been back to New York to give lectures and Broadway and so on. But I haven't. I mean, I can't, as Middle East correspondent, start investigating a story 12,000 kilometres away, which is well in my area. Our correspondents, if they want in New York and Washington, can do that. But I simply don't have the. I mean, it's not my area to cover. I can't.
Sure.
I can ask questions about it as anybody else can. You see, one of the things I've got at the moment is that I've got a column which can be about anything. Mm. And I've got my ordinary job of reporting the Middle East, quite apart from, you know, writing books and travelling and giving lectures and so on, which is really wearing me out sometimes. But it's, you know, the column has given me a way to explore journalism in a way I hadn't had a chance before. It's produced that book as well. But, you know, when you're coming down to the reporting side, It's not that, I mean, the editor would be quite happy for me to go off and spend a year, I'm sorry, probably investigating it, but I don't particularly want to. I've got a story I like in the Middle East. I know it's to do with the Middle East, of course. I mean, I know Ziad Jarrah, for example, his family, I know very well, the Lebanese guy who brought the plane down in Pennsylvania.
Right.
I know, I'm almost first name terms with father, and I call to see them when I go past. I saw them first about the Saturday after 9/11, I went to see them.
That's been very difficult.
Well, I was the only reporter who got to see them. But since then, I've called in and seen the family, and they've changed their views, of course, slowly. And the first thing was, we don't know he's dead, because we haven't seen a body or a passport. Mm. And then his next birthday was due, and his father bought him a brand new black Mercedes for his birthday, middle class family. But he's dead. He bought him a new Mercedes for his birthday, because he's going to come home. But he's a very sad man, because, you know, he's a government tax inspector.
Right.
Revenue strikes again, and the mother was a very good school teacher of French. Mm. So it's a very educated family. Christian schools, he went to Christian school in Zahle. I learned a lot about him.
Fascinating stories about bin Laden there, I actually hadn't heard. What interested me is that in the immediate aftermath, it's a funny story of bin Laden and the credit for 9/11 is in the immediate aftermath. Apparently spoke to a Pakistani newspaper and said it wasn't him, and the Taliban then said,
"I don't think that's correct.
We'll hand him over if you give us evidence suggesting he was playing the innocent to them as well." Was there any indication what he wanted to talk to you about when?
No,
when, no, none at all.
But he doesn't work like that. You get a message that he would like to see you, and then they suggest where you might like to go to be picked up.
Sure.
So I didn't have any message from him.
So you don't think it was him who said spoke to the Pakistani paper? And
He did speak to a Pakistani paper, yes, he did. He talked to a guy I know, whose name I can't remember, but it's in my book outside. He did, but I don't remember him denying it at the time.
I wish he had talked about it with me. I'm sure he condemned it in some way, as it was un-Islamic.
Yeah, he's also virtually accepted in other purposes. You know, and I think he was involved in it in some way, but he may not have been, you know. Okay?
Fantastic.
Okay,
yeah.
There you go.
If you ever do want to look into 9/11 more, Architects and Engineers, 9/11 Truth, that's the one to look at.
I've heard of it. I've heard of it. I think I got you sent it.
That was Stefan with Robert Fisk. It's a little disappointing that he won't look into 9/11 seriously. I mean, he explained he's got a very busy schedule and he's based in the Middle East, but surely you'd think he'd have access to the internet, and that would be a start, right? While Mr. Robert won't look into 9/11 anymore, Professor Niels Harrit is doing just that. Niels Harrit is Associate Professor of Chemistry at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark. Denmark is a country, I can tell you that. Professor Harrit ran a workshop and presentation around the third tower, WTC7, for We Are Change UK, and this was held at the Aspira Lounge in Camden Town. Kat caught up with him afterwards.
All right, well, that was a really engaging, interesting talk.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much at the Inspira Lounge in Camden. Could you just tell us a little bit about your background?
My background?
Yeah.
Well, I'm a scientist. I've studied chemistry. I'm 63 years old. I've studied chemistry at the university since the age of 18, which makes it, I can't count it, 45 years. I have been employed also in a university position since 1970, which also is a pretty long time ago. And I'm doing teaching and research, primarily within organic chemistry, but I'm recently working a lot with physicists.
So what made you look particularly into the physics of 9/11?
I saw, accidentally, Building 7. Collapsing, and immediately I wondered why. This is the bent of my nature, and actually it is the bent of every natural scientist's nature to ask questions, to ask why, and why is this, whenever we see a phenomenon, automatically, instinctively, we think, why is this happening? And there were no obvious explanation for why a 200 meters high building with a large footprint should collapse like that. So I had to see it again and again and again and again, and it took me actually a couple of hours to really appreciate what I had seen, you know. So it was sinking in that this is something important. And I have been hooked ever since. I would rather play with my grandchildren, but there's no way back for me.
What is it particularly then? I'm assuming it's the comparisons that you can draw up from the planes hitting the World Trade Centers, mm-hmm. or the South Tower,
yep.
and then them collapsing, mm-hmm. and then no plane hitting World Trade Center 7 yeah. and collapsing in the same manner.
Yeah.
Would you say that that's correct?
First, the simple version, obviously, for anyone who has not heard about Building 7, what should be pointed out is that there were two airplanes, but there were three skyscrapers. And this fact, anyone who can count to two and count to three should stop and think about this. There's something strange going on here. But when you start to look into the physics and the chemistry of the World Trade Center collapses, which is my specialty, put it this way, I can tell you that the towers did not come down because of the airplanes. The airplanes was an excuse for a very spectacular event. That's it. The technical report, the NIST report on the towers, do not deal with the collapse itself. Many people think that once NIST came out with their report in September 2005, we had an official explanation, which is not true, because the NIST report, which amounts to 14,000 pages total, does not deal with the collapse itself. The timeline stops at the time the towers are about to come down. So there is no official account of the towers collapse. Yes.
One of the main things about your presentation tonight was the NIST report of the collapse of Building 7.
Yeah.
For people that haven't seen that, who are listening to the podcast, it's yeah. just really bizarre. Could
yeah.
you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, because this is very recent stuff. Obviously, the NIST report, and it's still a draft, came out in August 2008. And the press conference, and NIST has also produced a small video, and they also produced a PowerPoint presentation in support of their hypothesis. And it's very easily digestible for the mainstream media, and it has been covered by all the mainstream media and reproduced the NIST version of things. But it's all wrong, which means that I have to present NIST's point of view and NIST's mechanism, hypothesis, and then go against it and show the real evidence and why they're wrong. Which is a very tedious piece of work, because I'm wasting my time because other people have not done their work properly and because they're cheating and lying. But this is our destiny. We have to do it this way. But I don't like it. And it was not very well done. It's very difficult to present other people's erroneous hypothesis. You should understand. Okay? But we're doing this interview now here, what is it, October? So the NIST report is very recent. Many scientists have spoken against it. We only got 3 weeks response time on 1,000 pages report. And immediately we objected, and we want to have this time frame extended. We will have more time to read it, and they wouldn't give it. The argument was that the report on the towers, which was 14,000 pages, were given 6 weeks response time. So for 1,000 pages, 3 weeks should be enough. You understand? We only got 3 weeks to respond. This was before September the 15th. But still, before September 15th, there was very serious response from a whole group of scientists to NIST. They were told what was wrong. And you can find this on the internet.
Thank you very much. Really good.
So we're standing here on Governor Square outside the embassy of the United States of America. and we're behind the banners which say investigate 9/11. Let's ask a couple of people standing here who are from We Are Change and Truth Action, 9/11 Truth Action, why they've come out.
So I think you need to, it kind of needs to reach critical mass to a point where everyone knows, and so it's not kind of isolated groups, isolated people, and that kind of enables, you can kind of ridicule them and guess without and get away with it. And but whereas if you have a mass movement of the whole population or the majority of the population, then people have to start like take notice and listen to what they're saying.
Because 7 years on after 9/11, there's maybe 1 million people dead in Iraq at the moment, and there's a lot of people dying of depleted uranium. The waters in Iraq are very highly contaminated with depleted uranium. There's a lot of hospitals being destroyed, and a lot of the people are in civil war in Iraq. The people of Afghanistan have been at war for the last 16 years, and there's very, very little being done to redress the situation. At the moment, it looks like maybe the government of the United States want to invade Iran on the same pretext. So we must be aware that for the people of the world, 9/11 hasn't gone away, and the people are still suffering. There's over maybe 1.5 million people suffering directly from the immediate impact because of debts in their families, because their immediate debt, and because they haven't the access to freedom of the press. So what little freedom of the press we have in this country, we must actually use it to the best of our kind of ability. The fact that we're allowed here today at this moment in time is kind of very, very fortunate for us, because in around 2 years' time, with the draconian laws that have been introduced in this country since 9/11, with the SOPCA laws and other laws, the right to protest is diminishing rapidly, and we soon will not have any right to protest at all. So we must, with the last few months, years, or whatever we've got left, actually exercise our right.
Obviously, a lot has happened across the world in terms of war in Iraq, and also here we're seeing big problems in terms of our civil liberties being taken away on the grounds of security, and a lot of young people are getting stopped under the Terrorist Act. Everybody's getting searched and seems to have no rights anymore. So really I'm here today and this week to talk to people and to just really get into debate and conversation about what's going on.
Today what we're doing here is we're standing proud by our big banner that says Investigate 9/11. And hundreds of motorists are going past and looking at it and seeing it. And they're looking quite thoughtful, like the cabbie going past now. So it's quite effective. Having a large number of people here makes it more credible, makes people take notice.
I'm here at the American Embassy on 9/11, and I'm here to raise awareness to the public that basically just to question what happened that day, because we all know it's dodgy. Most people I've spoken to have said they do think something was something untoward, but we just want them to really investigate that, and we just want an investigation. So I'm here mainly to raise awareness. I think the more you look into it, the more it stinks, the more evidence there is, and I'm so glad that I know the truth. I just wish everyone else did too.
Because I still light a candle for the two people I know who died in the towers.
Okay.
And I don't believe that what we've been told about how and why they died is the truth. I haven't put the Holocaust to rest yet, and that destroyed half of my family, so why should I put this to rest?
Okay. Let's get ready as we're all going on the Peace March in a few minutes, marching to Oxford with Brian Haw. Before that, let's hear a bit more from one of the dedicated activists who made the trip. Carolyn is in conversation with Stefan.
Okay, so can you tell us how you came to be in court recently?
I'd read a book called How I Clobbered Every Bureaucratic Cash Confiscatory Agency Known to Man by Mary Elizabeth Croft.
Sounds good.
On a site called freedomfiles.org. And I'd read this. It's a 96-page sort of testament to what she did herself. And it's all about contract law and how when you're born, the government requires you to register your child's birth within 6 weeks. And this person that they create with this name, the government then takes this legal fiction to the bank to raise as collateral for loans.
Right.
So because there's no gold, you are basically enslaved to the system forever with the prison, the fiction, money.
This is from your birth, your mind. From your birth certificate.
From your birth certificate.
Right.
Yeah. It's the registration. Once you register your child's birth, you've basically given up ownership over them, and the government gets to give them over to the bank as collateral for loans.
Right. Okay.
And this corporate entity that they've created, this fiction called a person, is what they get to act upon through the laws and statutes that they have made under Admiralty law,
right,
which they've imposed on top of contract law.
Okay. So talk us through, how did you end up in court in the first place? What was
I went past Threadneedle Street, and I'd been planning to go to the Bank of England for a while. I was with my dog and my peace flag. And I thought, oh, Threadneedle Street. I was on my way somewhere else at the time, actually. I was basically going to deliver a letter to Tony Blair at his office in Grosvenor Square. And I thought I'd take a little detour. So I went to the bank to claim back the legal fiction that they tax and claim all this money from, and to expose the fraudulent money system. And went in, and of course they turfed me out. And so I stood on the steps, and as they wouldn't send anyone down to speak to me, I decided to announce to the public. And I got quite a big crowd of people listening to what they were doing with their children from this registration process. And within sort of minutes, there was this siren screeching. I thought, I wonder if they're coming for me. And these two, a van and a police car pulled up. And they looked really fired up. You know how they are after they've been in the siren cars and everything themselves, and they've been rushing, and they were practically running out of the car. So I thought, I'm not staying here. So I started walking down the road with my peace flag and the dog, much to the amusement of the crowd who'd just been listening to me. They were all laughing. Of course, the woman comes up behind me and grabs my arm with the WPC and says she needs to take some details. So I turned around to speak to her, and as I did that, this other police officer walked around the back of her and said, that could be used as a weapon, meaning my peace flag.
Using a peace flag as a weapon?
Yeah.
It's a mighty ironic weapon. There.
Yeah, and he starts trying to grab it. So I said, I would never ever hurt anybody. I'm a pacifist. I said, this is ridiculous. And so he started to try and get the peace flag, and I did resist.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the sort of material that I've been reading, it said that if you come to be arrested, then basically that you don't submit to it, but you don't fight it either.
Yeah.
The idea is that you say, if you do this, it's under protest and duress at all times, because that gives them no jurisdiction at all times, even if they take jurisdiction. But I wasn't going to let go of my peace flag. I did let go of my dog, because I thought at least they won't hurt him, and I didn't want him to get involved in any fighting.
Right. I've seen your dog.
He's a peace dog.
I know, but from the looks of him, we're going to get involved in a fight with him, would you?
He was so sweet, he didn't hurt anyone. Blimmin' heck, I mean, like, I was being attacked virtually.
Yeah.
But I wasn't violent at all. I think if I'd have hit them back, then the dog would have gone. But
sure.
I just stood and held on to the peace flag. Anyway, ends up, this guy, with my hands up behind my back.
Mm-hmm.
I've still got hold of the peace flag, so he breaks it out of my hand, the stick that it was on. He broke it, so I was left just with a little broken stick in my hand, peace flag on the ground.
Right.
Which I think is a perfect sort of representation of what happens to people when they just try and speak the truth. And I was saying to him, I've done nothing wrong, I'm just speaking the truth. Well, anyway, I'd been for a meal beforehand, and I'd had a beer.
Mm-hmm.
So they then decided that I was drunk and disorderly, at which point they decided that I was to go down on the ground. So they had me down on the ground, hands up right behind my back. They were pressing my pressure points. They damaged the nerve in my thumb. My thumb is still hurting weeks. This is about 4 weeks now. And kept me for 6 hours, kept my dog downstairs. So he's a true activist. And
just on time now.
Yeah, and they then charged me with drunken disorderly and bailed me to appear the following in 7 days.
And did they breathalyse you to work out?
No, I actually said, breathalyse me, I can prove that I'm not drunk. And they said, we don't have to breathalyse you because it's not a drinking driving offence.
Right, they so you can just decide you're drunk.
Yeah, so I said, so therefore it's all hearsay evidence. He said, I've seen the police statements. He said, and I'm satisfied, we've got a case. I said, but it's all hearsay. I said, because they don't know whether I'm drunk or not. I said, you've heard how I'm speaking, I'm completely articulate. You haven't had me do any, tested me for anything to do with alcohol. But anyway, that was the charge. Sort of fair enough. So I then consulted with my friends at TPUC.org, T-P-U-C.
What does that stand for?
The People's United Collective. And it's a guy called John Harris who discovered the truth about the statutes, along with the help of some people in America. Like there's a guy called Robert A. Menard who has done a couple of films, one called Bursting Bubbles of Government Deception and another called The Magnificent Deception. And these really are very good explanations of what the state does in order to gain jurisdiction over you. So anyway, I was told basically to answer questions with questions. And one of the key things is when you go into the court, when they ask you your name, you say, if I answer that question, will I be entering it into contract with you? Because the thing with statutes and acts is that they have to be with both parties' consent, which people don't realise. And because they've got us through repetition and conditioning to accept that our birth certificate is our identity, this name is our identity, this corporate fiction, we unwittingly contract with them again and again without realising they're doing it. So when they ask our names, we think we have to answer. Now, if you said, I refuse, you could be given a contempt.
Right.
But if you say, if I answer that question, you're basically hitting the ball back to them. You've not caught the ball, so you've not given them jurisdiction.
Sure.
So I go into the court on this morning and report into the list caller, and he asks me what plea I will be entering. And I said, I won't be entering a plea. And he said, oh, but they'll want you to enter a plea. And I said, yes, of course they will, because they will want to have jurisdiction over me. But I am not willing to enter into a contract with this court. He then asked me if I wanted to see the duty solicitor. And I said, no, the duty solicitor will not be able to help me on this. They won't know this law. They'll know Admiralty law. So he said I would be first up because I was defending myself. So I stood up when they caught, well, after the court rising, there was this very beautiful young blonde magistrate who was the one who would be speaking with their two advisors. And she came in, she was very pleased and very happy. She was very pretty, lovely blonde, beautifully brushed hair. And she sat with her hands on the table, ready and eager to deliver justice to the masses. So,
you think she was new?
She looked new. Just born, almost. So the case was called and I stood up and they opened the door of the dock. And I said, I'm not going in there. And her little hands went up, the magistrate, and she started looking around as if for help. And I thought, oh. Anyway, he then said, all defendants go in the dock. You have to go in. And I said, I never go in those boxes. And I looked at the magistrate, I said, I'm not a criminal. And with that, they knew what my next step was, because this is what I'd been talking about outside the Bank of England, which would be to not give my name under the idea that they would contract with me. So as soon as I said that I wasn't a criminal, this shout went up from the corner, this edge side of the court, the case is withdrawn, withdrawn. And they went and handed the paper over to the magistrate and I was free to go.
Very interesting.
I know, isn't
so
it?
So your advice to somebody, if they're in a similar situation, ask whether, if they give their name, they'd be entering a contract.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. The only answer is yes. You see, because unless they don't answer and try and waffle their way out of it, they will try and get you in all kinds of ways to contract with them. Like, they will ask you to do something that is contracting. Anything can be termed contracting.
Sure.
As soon as you interact without a question. So the idea is to keep asking questions.
Okay.
And do your research, basically. Do your research and look into claiming back the straw man fiction which they've created, which you can do. It's actually about claiming back this bond number, which is in your name.
Sure.
Yeah.
So just one more time, this website you're recommending to people?
Is www.tpuc.org.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Caroline.
Yeah.
Now, the weather outside's not looking too bad at the moment, so why don't we go for a walk with Brian?
My name's Brian Hoare, and I'm with some of my wonderful extended family here, and we are walking to Oxford on a peace walk. The idea is I'm going to be speaking in Oxford Union on the 7th of February, and the topic is this house under no circumstances would fight for Queen and country. And this is a rerun of their most famous debate in their history 75 years ago, 1933. That was the rise of fascism. They had a debate. This house, under no circumstances, would fight for king and country. And that was passed. Well, people are dying at this moment in time. Our country is engaged in a filthy war, all based upon lies, infanticide, genocide, torture, looting of nations. That's what's going on. And it's as if the country's asleep and as if nobody's noticing. It's as if we're at war, if you please, our country, but you wouldn't know that in this country, would you? No bombs are falling here, and it's as if it's all happening over there. But some of us are in touch with the people who are doing the suffering.
So whereabouts are we?
I have no idea. We're on the road to Oxford. That's all I need to know.
Yeah. This is like the quietest it's been. Absolutely no cars.
Yes, quite nice, isn't it? We've been really lucky. It's been a beautiful journey. We had a little dash of rain yesterday, but it was just clear the air. Very nice. Mm-hmm. Nice stroll. Good company, too. Good people.
How do you know Brian?
I met Brian shortly after he first came up the square. Because I got up to shenanigans of political dissent when I was in Canada and got chased out the country by the beloved state. So I found Brian and I thought, ooh, ah, here's a man who stands for something. And as my first husband was an Iraqi who escaped from Baghdad because he didn't want to fight in Saddam's wars, I have my eldest daughter's a beautiful Iraqi babe. So I thought, this man is speaking out for her. I like that. Tremendous courage to see him there day after day. And thank God there is someone like Brian who's trying to bring some sanity back into democracy.
He used to be a carpenter, didn't he?
Oh. Brian is an amazing human being. Yes, he did used to be a carpenter. He used to make beautiful furniture. But in this MFI world, there was no place for him. And Brian did go walkies about. He went to Cambodia to see what Pol Pot was up to. And he saw the killing fields. And he did go to Iraq in 91, I believe it was, and saw the effects of our sanctions, our punishment on the Iraqi people. Not in the regime. So you've got this simple man with such a big heart and a beautiful wife and seven kids. And yeah, he had eight children. And one of them died. And he watched that little babe fight for its breath in the incubator, fighting to live, to survive. And of course, that's a life-changing moment. So he understands he truly understands what it's like to see your child suffer, to see your child die. He's there to say, do you know what? Stop your nonsense. Let's start dealing in the truth. Stop your lies. Let's start talking the truth. Can we have some peace, please? Can we live in the truth?
By the way, people, do we know what's going on? Do we know? Bomb! Burn, bugger, beggar your neighbour. That's what it is. Check it out for yourself. It's what we do. It's what we do. Check out DU. Check out DU. Dumb, dumb, dumb. Depleted uranium munitions. Our raw material, our nuclear waste. Check out what it does to the babes. Check it out. Check out the horror of what we are inflicting upon our neighbors' babies. Check it out. Google depleted
Urania. Check it out. Parliament-square.org. Check out our website. Why are we here? We're here to bear witness and to save lives. We are here to say my neighbour's babe, my neighbour's child, my neighbour's wife, my neighbour's mum and grandmum, my neighbour is as precious as my own child. You are my brother, my sister. We may be born in different countries. We may have different religions, different customs, different clothing, different languages. But we are all human beings, aren't we? And when are we going to behave like human beings?
I knew about him because I'd seen his campaign. And then February the 23rd last year, there was the march against Trident replacement organised by Stop the War. And so we went on about 8 minutes, I think it was. Anyway, I wanted to hear the speech again. I was really moved by what he said, you know, stop killing the kids. It was just a really simple message. And I was actually crying. I actually had tears running down my face because I thought, well, finally, someone on the platform isn't just speaking politics. And I liked it because it was just straight and honest. And started off saying all the words of peace. Mm-hmm. And I had such huge respect for Brian. But I could see, when I saw him, I thought, it's like he was just battered down. And I thought, we people have got to do something to actually support this man. It's just killing him, you know, the hopelessness of it. So I started going up and taking homemade food and stuff like that, first of all. Yeah, and I've been sort of going there ever since, staying in Parliament Square in the tent about half the week. I'm there as much as I can be there. People really need to wake up to the truth of what's happening in this country. If they don't know about Brian, then they don't know about anything, and they are like sheep being led by people who would lead them over the edge of the cliff and let them die and rot there. So if they don't know about Brian, I suggest they start finding out about Brian, what he represents, and they start finding out about depleted uranium, cluster bombs, and the actual law. Not just say the Iraq war is illegal. Right, we go to the actual law. Statute of Rome, Article 25, says to provide the means is against the law. It makes you criminally responsible. In fact, Statute of Rome, Article 25, that article is called Individual Criminal Responsibility, and it applies to every single member in the UK. In the United States, of course, George Bush didn't ratify it, but Tony Blair did ratify it in 2001. Which means every single citizen in this country is responsible for the actions of the government, and they really need to know what the government is doing, therefore, so they need to know what's going on in the world, mm-hmm. what weapons they're using, how the war is illegal, what makes it illegal. 6, 7 and 8A of the Statute of Rome talk about what is genocide, what are crimes against peace, what are crimes against humanity. I think the people have to speak on it, the Iraqi people and the people of this country as well. Power to the people.
Yes, we normally reside opposite parliaments. The Hammer House of Horror. That's where we normally stay. And there they are across the road. And they roll out very well sloshed. Oh yes, let me just. Sober up, Britain, sober up. The children have no clean drinking water, and we get pissed. It's not nice, is it? Children are starving, and we get fat. And we spend a fortune getting fat, and then another fortune at the stomach clinics, getting slim again. Isn't that smart? Let's stop being so bloody greedy. Let's stop stealing and looting from the rest of the world. Let's have some humanity, eh? Let's show some real love. Love between our brothers and sisters. All over. All of the lands. Down to you. Down to me. either make peace, or we can let the warmongers make war forever and ever. Amen. We say for peace.
My name is Yumiko, I'm from Japan. I went just by chance. I went to Westminster Abbey on last May and I found a tent in front of Parliament. So I spoke to them. I was just surprised, first time I know what he's doing.
Yeah.
Because camping 6 years is almost impossible, I feel. So I searched his name on Google Japan and just few results came from. So most of Japanese people don't know about him. For me, he's maybe not mainstream, but for me, I feel he represents British society. Yeah, it's really so strong and have opinion, even he doesn't have much freedom, but still fighting is, for me, impressive.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I just wish to express my deepest, warmest, most heartfelt thanks for your love and your care and your compassion and your stupidity and your aching feet and backs and whatever else that I won't talk about, your personal bits that are knackered and worn out, because you walked 60 miles from Parliament Square in Westminster to Oxford Union. It's not very far when you look at the whole wide world. Not very far, is it? 60 miles. And when we consider that dear African lady who has to walk mile upon mile each day to get water and firewood or carry it on her head, 60 miles is a bit easy peasy over 4 days, isn't it? But it is rather unusual for us soft, I won't say fat, although we can each, anyway, whichever, soft Westerners, we didn't actually need to walk 60 miles, did we? We could afford the fare, it wasn't that much. But we did it as a small gesture to show that this is important. Many years ago, the Jarrow Marchers marched because there was great suffering and great unemployment. And they marched because it was important. And we march today because it is by far more important. What's the value of my neighbour's baby, my neighbour's kid? Every child is precious, said Gordon Bennett, Bloody Brown. He was right about the words, but it's a pity he didn't mean it, isn't it? Because when you check it out, over a decade, Gordon Bennett Brown has been the bag man for the mafia, and he's provided the finances for infanticide, genocide, torture, looting of nations. It's not nice, is it? It's not nice. But anyway, you're nice, and I love you. And God bless you all for walking with me. Thank you so much. And we're here.
Thank you.
So well
Thank
done.
You,
three cheers to one and all. Hip hip.
Hooray.
Hip hip.
Hooray.
Hip hip.
Hooray.
This house, under no circumstances, would fight for Queen and country. Which Queen? Which country? Queen George W. Bush? Queen Tony Blair? Queen Gordon Brown? Or perchance, this Queen? Her Majesty, as the lady is known, Elizabeth Regina? I understand her family used to have a German name. Who are we going to fight for? Who are we?
It's our choice, isn't it? It's our choice. Fighting! Fighting! Aren't the boys macho? Aren't the boys big and brave when it comes to being? Blah, blah, blah. God's sake, when are we going to grow up? When are we going to grow up and become human beings? My country, my country. GB, is it Great Britain or is it genocidal Britain? Who do we ask? Let's ask the whole bloody wide world, shall we? Why not? By the way, why weren't the people of Britain invited to vote when Georgie Porgie Puddin' and Pie decided he was going to go to war? Why weren't we the 51st state given a vote? Why weren't we? Why were we not? I want to know, don't you? Yeah. Democracy? Freedom? Preaching freedom and democracy as we come, the reality of broomstick up the bum. Oh, isn't that nice? Isn't that very, very nice? I'm sorry. I hear all this macho talk of war and fighting and it turns my stomach. Turns my fucking stomach, pardon my French. And the first speech was, of course, the cheese-eating surrender monkeys, wasn't it? The cheese-eating... Oh, by the way, the five permanent members of the Security Council of the United Nations. Five big boys who decide what to do for the rest of the world. Oh, yeah. Oh, and has anybody else checked their law out? Have they checked the process and the due process and how it works? And each one of these five permanent members, these five big boys, has a veto. And France said no. And China and Russia. But it didn't matter because Georgie Porgie, well, he was told what to do, wasn't he? Don't blame George, the village idiot. Don't blame him. Don't blame Mr. Anthony Blair. Mr. Blyer, don't blame him. Hey, blame. When are we going to become responsible? Responsible! We are each responsible. Bomb them all, bomb them all, bomb them all. The ones of the veil or the shawl. Bomb all those Afghans, Iraqis and Kurds. Bomb all their weddings, their wells and their herds. For we're pre-hunting death to them all. As under the rubble they sprawl. Where the DUs are boil in their water and soil. The beer's up, my lords, bomb them all. Check out. Depleted uranium munitions. Check that one out. Depleted uranium munitions. We take our nuclear waste, we form it into a weapon, and we dump it on the country of any leader who does not do what we tell him to. Serbia, Sarajevo, Yugoslavia, Kosovo, Afghanistan, Iraq. A couple of thousands of tons at least of our nuclear waste dumped on our neighbour's base. Google depleted uranium. Do your homework, educate yourself. See what we've done to their babies. See what we've done. And we speak so patronising, so superciliously. There's nothing more insufferable than the British at their worst, is there? Who the hell do we think we are? I'm 59 years old now. When I was a kid, half of the world was painted pink, wasn't it? The British Empire. And by what virtue and by what right did this tiny little country get to own half the world? How did it happen? Bomb them all, bomb them all, bomb them all. With shot and with shell, let us maul. Don't count their dead, miss the mosque if you must. but burn 'em to crisp, napalm 'em to crust, for we're smashing these states to the wall, and who dares answer their call? With all NGOs gone, our party is still on. So beers up, my lords, bomb 'em all. Oh yeah, I should really get back to Her Majesty, shouldn't I?
Point of information, sir.
Later, sir, later. Time is very limited. All the questions in the world, later. Yes, which queen, which country? I understand this lady, Her Majesty, Elizabeth Regina, when she was a young lady, at Westminster Abbey, just across the road from where I normally reside, under sufferance for the duration. I'm not enjoying, but I don't want to be there, thank you very much. You might like to pass that on to Parliament. He doesn't bloody want to be there. You're spending all your time trying to get rid of him. He doesn't want to be there. You've done laws, you've done all the attack by the plods, all the naughty, nasty business. Send along the nutters. Anyway, he didn't want to be there. Do you know there's another alternative? Stop the war. Do you know why I'm there? Infanticide, genocide, torture, looting of nations. That's what's going on, have we noticed? In our name. Oh, by the way, soldiers don't sacrifice their lives. They don't give them away. They don't intend to die, do they? And which soldier goes into the field thinking, right, I'm going to volunteer to die today? They don't. Of course they don't want to die. And why are our boys dying? Like filthy creatures like Malcolm Rifkin can make filthy, filthy fortunes. CEO of Armour Group. Yes, they have the private contract for the security at the Kabul embassy. Yes, 189 million. Nice little earner, isn't it? Plenty more little earners. Check out what's going on, folks. Check out the arms industry, the biggest money-making racket in the world. Check out the drugs industry, the second biggest money-making racket in the world. Check out Afghanistan, the oil in the Caspian Sea, the American pipeline, the poppy! Do you remember about drugs? Chinese people do. They haven't forgot the opium wars, you know. Noriega, the Iran-Contra scandal, the CIA, yes, drugs. The second biggest money-making racket in the world is drugs. Outside our parliament, I've been there nearly 7 years, day and night, 24-7. And there's some glorious, wonderful human beings of all different countries of the United Nations with us. And we are there to bear witness and save lives. We are there to say that our neighbour's kid, our neighbour's babe, mum, dad, whatever, is as precious as ours. That's what I've been calling out to Mr. George Bush and Tony Blair. George W. Bush, Tony Blair, Christians, murderers! Repent! I tell you one, the only thing that's going to change anything is love. All the hate in the world. It was the commie bastards yesterday, wasn't it? There's always a new enemy. Face of the enemy in Kabul. That's what the picture said of the babe on in front of our parliament. Face of the enemy in Hanoi. There'll always be a new face, a new enemy for the arms industry. And we've got to change things now, and I thank you young people with all from the bottom of my heart that you are seriously good young people who are considering, and I'm damn glad, and what other sense can you say? This house under no circumstances will fight you. Of course you ain't going to fight the Queen of Country. You know it's all bollocks, don't you? I mean, just look at it. Just look at it. But all this stupid talk, do your homework. Learn about soccer, serious organised crime and police act. Hitler did it in 33, Blair did it in 2005. They've stolen the rights of the people to speak and the people don't even know it. Wake up, people. I ask you to support this motion for humanity, for Christianity. I've got a lot more to say as you'll gather, but I think that was a little tinkling glass saying, shut up, Brian, it's not. But please, consider this. Are you going to go and fight? Of course you're not daft enough. Dear Mr. Goering, you might have heard of him a while back. Of course the people don't want to go to war. Why should they? Why should they? Why should some poor slob on a farm go off and fight when the best they can hope for is coming back in one piece? Of course he doesn't. Then he went on to say how it can be arranged by the rulers, and it doesn't matter whether it's a communist or a fascist or a democratic or whatever society, we can always arrange it. Well, I say, wake up, people. Britain, it's time to open our eyes. Look in the mirror. We actually make Hitler look like a pussycat if our people will dare and have the courage to look to see what we're doing. And we are great, and we're great and big enough to change that. What are we going to do? What are you going to do for peace and love and justice for all? Hope, salam, wa'adu, lerjamir, shalom, love, peace, justice for all. Now, amen.
Thank you for spending some time with We Are Change UK. Remember, if you want to see change, you need to be change. Get up, stand up, and get active. We'll play you out, as they say, with Akala. That's A-K-A-L-A. Check him out on the web, MySpace, Google, etc., etc. He is a MOBA award-winning hip-hop artist and the best, most conscious rapper in Britain. Probably. If you were lucky enough to catch his searing cameo appearance on Live 8 with Miss Dynamite, you'll know he doesn't mince words. This is Akala with Carried Away.
Another hearse roll up slow, carry one more poor lost soul. Carry them things every single day, cause it makes him feel safe. Cause carry on them ways, screw face, love the game, reppin' his estate. Talk tough, look straight in his face, carrying deep pain, so fake. Carry fam, so we carry weight. It's logical, daddy got carried away, not married away. Just didn't stay, this coward carried his son to this fate. His boy's carrying weight, and then when the box can't stand straight, they was getting out the game. But look, face, she don't wait. Now the woman in the front row, her face show no pain, but her brain went insane on the day the news came. Staring to space, face numb. The boy getting carried, she carried 9 months. When this world stripped me naked, I turn and I face it, and really believe I have the strength to change it. I'm crazy, it's blatant, sometimes I get carried away. When this world stripped me naked, I turn and I face it, and really believe I have the strength to change it. I'm crazy, it's blatant, sometimes I get carried away. One more body bag getting carried back from the war zone, where they carry straps, where little kids is attacking tanks, cause they carry no fear of the man. All they know here is they land on a hero, gotta make a stand, so they roll cold with it in their hand, let it bang on the big bad man. But this particular soldier never moved cold, and never enrolled to blow no homes. I felt that life done carried him under, chose to phone the number. The army give you training, nothing they say could really explain it, signing papers. Enslavement, now you're a tool to carry their hatred. Rob, still strip a nation, all he wanted was qualifications, so he could carry his family places. Better than those that he was raised. They never really thought he'd ever have to go to war. Now who's gonna tell his kids that he can't carry them no more? When this world stripped me naked, I turn and I face it, and really believe I have the strength to change it. I'm crazy, it's blatant, sometimes I get carried away. When this world stripped me naked, I turn and I face it, and really believe I have the strength to change it. I'm crazy, it's blatant, sometimes I get carried away.
When this world stripped me naked, I turn and I face it and really believe I have the strength to change it. I'm crazy, it's blatant, sometimes I get carried away. When this world stripped me naked, I turn and I face it and really believe I have the strength to change it. I'm crazy, it's blatant, sometimes I get carried away. Me naked, I turn and I face it and really believe I have the strength to change it. I'm crazy, it's blatant, sometimes I get carried away. When this war stripped me naked, I turn and I face it and really believe I have the strength to change it.